Movie theaters are modern-day pulpits. Real-world theology exists to shed a light on the narratives that are shaping our culture and to remind viewers that entertainment is not mindless.
Welcome to Real World Theology, episode 147, with two guests from Feel and Film, Aaron White and Jeremy Calcara. So listen up, because we've got a really selfless show for you. On this episode, we talk the big sick and a different type of love. Actually, have I ever talked about this would be a pretty great thing to talk about on about the actual movie, but I have a real problem with casual sex in movies. It almost instantly makes me dislike a character.
So it's interesting that you brought that up, because this time during my rewatch, that stuck out like a sore thumb to me.
That thing?
And are we talking about in The Big Sick? Yeah. The fact that everything stems from a one-night stand and there are no consequences for it, as far as not directly related to the fact that it's a one-night stand and the sex. There's no consequence for that portion of it.
Okay.
And it did, blaringly stand out to me this time.
So it's not just that the relation stems from that, which kind of, paints this picture that, that's an acceptable way for relationships to start.
Yeah.
Look at how high and mighty I sound. That's not acceptable. but what really bothers me about that is, The Big Sick is based, on the real story. Not, obviously there's lots of differences and you can read the trivia and see all the things that are changed. But I'm wondering, which is an unfortunate laser focus that I have, when they first break up, he basically goes right back to the bar and sleeps with another girl.
Uh-huh.
And it is just that's never a thing. Did he actually do that? Do you have that conversation? At what point, when you don't value intimacy, does that not matter anymore? I know we broke up for 2 days, but we were broken up, so it was okay that I had sex with this other person that I didn't know anything about. I probably couldn't even tell you their name. You wouldn't be upset about that, right? I mean, you were in a coma. So
we were on a break, right? It's up from Friends. We were on a break. It's all good.
Oh man, that is, that is oddly just really. I mean, I was understanding the premise and the direction of the movie. I realize this isn't a film about a sweet little Christian couple who is going to save themselves or whatever. So get that out of the way, let that go, and realize that this is going to be more general rom-com. So they're going to get together because they hook up first. Okay, fine.
Yeah, I mean, it bothers me every time too. It's just that's Hollywood shorthand for, oh, they're in love now. And it really, I don't know, when you tell such a sweet love story like the rest of the movie,
mm-hmm.
It seems like there's probably a better way to show that, especially, I mean, just reading about their actual relationship. That's not mm-hmm. even how it started. And so it's like, well, why don't you adapt the way it actually happened or whatever? Not that I expect them to have, total Christian values in their relationship, but starting it off like that's kind of, I don't know, I don't like it.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the weird part too, because is that just too boring, or they spent so much time in this film. I feel like the first thing we're going to say about this movie is things that were really annoying to us when it's a movie that we all really, really liked. Spoilers, we all like this film a lot. But it is really, really weird to me that all the characters seem so three-dimensional and likable, and they've spent so much time crafting these scenes, and even the tertiary characters are kind of they have some depth to them, and you're following them and you care about them. So obviously there was time put in this movie. So why use the thing that I think is one of the laziest things in romantic comedies, which is, let's just have them sleep together. Because if you sleep with someone, you know, you really like them, even though by doing that, they're actually saying that you don't really have to like someone to sleep with them. It's weird that trope is a thing.
Well, I think it's more than a trope, though. I think that the problem probably is that it's stemmed from reality. Like, in reality, this is a norm of society now. So it's not shocking. It's what people experience. The world believes that you hook up on Match.com, you go out, you sleep with each other, that's romantic, and then you like each other because you slept with each other, so you have another date. And ultimately, like in this movie, it ends up in this actual authentic kind of love. When in reality, we know that so many of those relationships fall apart eventually.
Well, and that's why I'm confused, because I feel like in this reality, like I said, we can see that this is something that is more of a cultural norm than probably any of us would like. And that doesn't really matter what we'd like or not. It's just a cultural norm. But in this cultural norm, that's not how it works out. Like, you people aren't necessarily sleeping with each other because they super like each other. They're sleeping with each other because they're, we just hooked up, or we just did this thing, and, it was just that one night, or I was in this particular state of mind, or whatever. So I mean, like, since that is the actual reality, isn't it ironic or kind of just odd that the reality is that's not the case, but somehow mentally in a story, we still believe that, like, that's how the trope works. The trope works because we see people get together, and if they hook up, then we understand that they like each other, which, like I said, is actually against reality. I feel like I'm saying the same thing over and over again, but it's just really odd, to me that's, the reality is so much different, yet we still buy in, like, as viewers of this story. It seems like we would be antithetical to this. We would say, no, that's not how it really works. But we're like, oh yeah, they like to see each other naked, so they must be, we want them to fall in love.
And what a crummy way to start your love story, by the way. I mean, when you're older, telling your kids are asking, how did you guys meet? Well, your mom got really drunk at a bar that I was performing at, and one thing led to another, and I don't know. It's like, especially in this movie, the rest of it, again, so sweet, wonderful, has me smiling ear to ear the entire time, but the beginning is just so cliched, or I don't know, just
I think I would have liked, I would have just liked some consequence for it. I would have liked him to had to speak it to her when she woke up, and had to kind of ask her forgiveness for the fact that he slept with somebody else, or at least tell the truth, you know, about what had happened. And we never see that, because as far as we know, it's just, like you said, Mikey, it's just kind of, it happened while you were asleep. So we don't ever have to tell her that. And since the other big problem with Camille is that he's a liar, whether it's justified or not in his mind, you know, he has a very big problem with lying, because he's trying to not deal with the fallout that's going to come from that in relationships and with his parents and culturally. And so I think it almost is like deception becomes a habit to him. You know, we see the same thing with Emily, with him withholding truth and information from her. And so it would have been really nice for me to have seen something that showed me he was going to go above and beyond to make an effort to tell the truth when it was hard.
Mm-hmm. Call me old fashioned, but I just think that when you are sexually intimate with somebody, like, there's a piece of you that you leave there. It means more than these movies tell me. And so I would say that, honestly, I think it's one of the most difficult things in the world to make a good romantic comedy. I think I think of all the genres that like we could cover, romantic comedies are one that we basically never cover on this show because they're all trite. They're lots of times they're just like almost like romance porn. It's just very simple, by the numbers, you know, guy, girl fall in love, something comes between them, then they get together at the end. And even though this thing is kind of sitting there annoying us, The Big Sick ends up transcending, I think, the genre and being like the romantic comedy that we've been waiting for a long time. Because I'm kind of curious if either of you guys tend to like watch romantic comedies. I know like this is one of those like emasculating questions, but you know, whatever. We need to be a little bit beyond that. But I like a good romantic comedy. Like I used to get a lot of flack because they would be like, well, you never want to go see romantic comedies in the theater. You never talk about romantic comedies. And I'm like, I love romantic comedies, or I like romance movies. I just like good ones, and there's so few to choose from. Am I alone in that?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I like a good one as well. And I said this earlier, but for me, it's all about consequences. I don't expect every movie to have a Christian worldview. You know, that's unrealistic. And the ones we do get that tends to be overly false in their depiction of a Christian worldview anyway.
Yeah.
To the other side of the coin, but I just want those consequences. And so I want, if a poor choice is made, I want there to be something that triggers a change in the person and an acknowledgement that it was a poor choice. That's all I would like to see. And it's, we live in a world that doesn't really take a lot of stock in taking ownership of mistakes. That's not a thing we do in 2017. And so asking our movies to give us characters that do that is, I think, hard for Hollywood to deliver on.
Hmm.
I guess I'm like you. I like a good romantic comedy, but I guess I'm pretty picky on what is good and what isn't good.
Mm-hmm.
I think that your average romantic comedy is detrimental, especially to like a single person's idea of what love and relationships are really like. And so, I don't know, when I'm watching any romantic comedy with Jennifer Lopez or something, you know, I just tend to sit there and get angry at, you know, the idea that, I don't know, that love involves like some sort of a meet cute and, you know, just these trite complications and stuff like that. So I do get annoyed quickly with a romantic comedy, but I do enjoy a good one.
Yeah, I mean, like I feel like there's probably only like five romantic comedies that I can think of that I've actually enjoyed, even though I've seen many. And even then, most of the ones that I really like tend to be comedies that have a little bit of romance in them. Like I think of something like Wedding Crashers. It's like a comedy, with tones of romance. But when
or
I
anything,
think,
I like the Apatow, like yeah, the 40-year-old virgins and you know, yeah, stuff like that. That's a comedy that I like, but it has a romantic aspect.
Yeah. So when I think of like actual romantic comedies, like, I feel like, you know, I'm putting like When Harry Met Sally up there, like at the top of the hill as something that defies the genre because it doesn't do what every romantic comedy does. And what it does is it gives us a scenario where we actually, as an audience member, fall in love with the characters before they actually fall in love with each other. Now they do have some of the same tropes that, obviously, or well, not tropes, but the pitfalls that we've already kind of railed against. And I want to make sure that what I'm saying, admittingly, in what is at a glance, I think what will sound like a very high and mighty kind of way, like, you know, we need these people to be punished for doing this thing. And it really disgusts us that they're being very flippant. And I realize that that's a reality to a lot of people. because that's just the world we live in. There were things that, you know, I've done that I'm not proud of in my past, and that's the case with the majority of everyone, especially in our culture. So I don't want to make people feel like crap if you found yourself in one of these situations. But when we're thinking about it in an ideal way, and you think about sex and sexuality in a way that is hopefully biblically based, it is really sad to see the flippancy in which people hook up and the hookup culture, and just the way that people talk about it. So despite seeing this in movies, it's almost like a given that it can let it slide for a little bit if the story around it is good enough. And I think that, again, circles us back around to The Big Sick, because I think we fall in love with most of these characters almost before they actually realize that they're falling in love with themselves. So we're rooting for them not because they have sex. We're rooting for them because they, again, seem like three-dimensional people with families and goals and aspirations and friends. And so it lessens the kind of distraction that the typical hookup would have. I mean, when we see Kumail, like, he is charming. He has these friends. He is mostly dealing with his family more than anything else. Zoe kind of, or not Zoe, but Emily, played by Zoe Kazan, she's kind of got her own life going on. So it's really not about their relationship at first. And then especially when she's in a coma, it's definitely not about that. But The Big Sick focuses on all these other things that really draw us in. So it allows us to almost get around this thing that's sounds, like I said, more than just a pet peeve, but something that we really should be annoyed at. So what I'm, I guess what I'm curious to specifically hone in on the movie itself is, since we get so many romantic comedies every year, and we have admitted that we, you know, we are fine with a romantic comedy or a romantic movie or however you define that, a romantic drama, a drama romance, a
dramedy,
dromance,
romantic dramedy,
a dramedy. That's just, that's like three different genres. So since we're fine, since we're fine with this, if it's good, but we're usually not checking out many of these because they're usually not very good, then like, how did each of you guys get drawn to seeing The Big Sick in the first place? Like, what were your expectations going into the film? And then what were your thoughts coming out? Especially, like, I think, Jeremy, it was you. I think when you saw this film, you were saying something like it was like the best film you'd seen all year, maybe? Was it?
Yeah, he saw it first.
Yeah. I currently have it on my 2017 rankings. I actually bumped it down to number two, but when I saw it, it was immediately, yeah, my favorite.
Mm-hmm. So why, like, again, like I said, we are typically not drawn to these films because they tend to be a dime a dozen, but something stood out about this, and like, what drew you to it? What were your expectations based on whatever drew you to it? And then, you know, expand upon how you felt when you left.
You know, I really like Kumail Nanjiani, and I've been a fan of his for a long time. His stand-up, I love him on Silicon Valley. When I first started listening to podcasts, like 5-6 years ago, I think the first podcast I ever listened to was Pete Holmes's You Made It Weird, and it was an interview with Kumail, and I was just sort of fascinated by his story, and mm-hmm. he talked a little bit about him and Emily back then, and so I was just pretty excited to see like an actual true story, and every little bit of buzz you saw around it was super positive. I think actually Don Shanahan, the Feeling Film contributor, I think he actually saw it before I did and said some pretty high things about it. Pretty high things, that's a weird way to say it. Pretty good things about it. And so, yeah, I was expecting it to be very good just because of the buzz, and, you know, I like Kumail. And, you know, I was just, I would say I've watched it twice more since you asked me to be on the podcast, and I would say repeated viewings I haven't loved it quite as much, but that first time in the theater, man, those last 45 minutes, I was like ugly crying with a smile went across my face for, you know, just the whole time, and just loved it. You know, I was so glad that I was the only one in the theater seeing it so I could sit and compose myself for a little while. So I just thought it was, beautiful. And just, I think the thing that makes it different from other romantic comedies is, you know, we talk about the sex at the beginning and how that kind of is typical rom-com stuff. But as far as like the falling in love was like through real circumstances that were hard and not easy. You know what I mean? It wasn't like a meet cute happily ever after sort of thing. It was mm-hmm. like a love that was earned through devotion. And I guess the way that I really feel like love actually works as opposed to the way it usually works in the movies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the things that draws me into these stories as well. When it looks like the reason that people are getting together is not just because they're two pretty people, or the biggest thing they have to overcome isn't, oh, my best friend saw you hanging out at a store that I don't like, and we had to have an honest conversation about that. Or like most sitcoms, like the deepest problem that most episodes have is it could easily be resolved if the two main characters just had like a 2-minute conversation with each other instead of just yeah. wandering around being confused for a half hour or 23 yeah, minutes.
Absolutely.
And you know, this isn't something that would be fixed. There are all the conflicts, cause there's more than one in The Big Sick, would not be fixed by people just having a 2-minute conversation. And that in and of itself makes it more like real life and not just kind of masquerading as complications.
Yeah, I think like as a married guy, there is a way to have 2-minute conversations that make everything all right, but it's they're basically not getting the issue out in the open. It's just saying I'm sorry or something to avoid an argument. And that's not real, you know. So if you really want to have a good relationship, that's you know, it's got to be conversation and walking away and being frustrated and coming back and, you know, when everybody's settled down and stuff like that. So that realistic nature, I think, was really drew me to the movie.
Mm-hmm. Aaron, yeah, I'm kind of curious. Same thing.
Well, for me, so I had barely heard about it. I know that I don't know if it premiered at SXSW, South by Southwest, or not, but it was in March of this year. And then Seattle, at our Seattle International Film Festival, this was actually our opening night gala film. And I had an opportunity to go, and I chose not to because I didn't care for romantic comedies. And it's all of, you know, Camille was there and they were all going to be there talking, and the director was there. And I'm a little disappointed in hindsight and kind of learned my lesson the hard way that maybe I should just take a risk next time, because I get just exactly what we were talking about earlier. It was all I knew was, oh, this is some new romantic comedy. And I was like, well, okay, not my genre. So I'm not going to go out of my way to see that. But then every one of my in the critic circle here in Seattle immediately was raving about it. And then Jeremy, I think, was the first one that I knew, Jeremy and Don both, who had gotten to see it and both just absolutely loved it. And I was like, OK, got to go see this movie. I'll give it a shot, even though I'm not a huge fan of Apatow in general. Mm-hmm. I mean, I like his stuff. It's not terrible, but it's not my favorite. And so I was kind of blown away when I saw it. I went in with very, very low expectations and mm-hmm. came out just shocked and floored and crying, honestly, because what draws me to film the most is when I feel like something takes a very realistic slant or direction. And The Big Sick, being mostly based on true stories, or a true story, at least largely so, and the way in which its conclusions play out, and in some cases don't, they're left unfulfilled, like Camille's relationship with his parents.
Mm-hmm.
There's hope there, but there's not a resolution. I really like that because it feels natural to me. It doesn't tie everything up with a bow, but it at the same time, it doesn't give you a negative, you know, downer kind of feeling. You get a boost because you know, okay, there's the spark, it's back, the relationship has potential. Maybe these two can connect and go forward. And because we know the true story, we know that eventually they do, and they become husband and wife and this great marriage, as far as we know. But, you know, everything about it, other than the initial sexual stuff, for me, I loved. I thought the jokes were perfect. It was my kind of humor. I don't like overly sexualized humor.
Mm-hmm.
Like 90% of comedies go to these days. And there is some, I'm also not like a comedy guy. So I don't typically watch stand-up comics and stuff like that. So I had no idea. I didn't know anything about Camille prior to this movie. I haven't watched Silicon Valley, but his style of joking, it doesn't feel like he's trying to make jokes. It feels like he's just like you or me trying to make, like, just talking in our normal everyday life.
So you mean hilarious? And because if it's me.
Exactly. And it turns out hilarious. So
that's right.
The way in which his wit, he's more witty than funny, I think. And so I really, really latched on to that. And then just watching him and his mentally change to someone who understood that love was going to be action oriented once she was in the hospital, and the way in which he starts to give of himself and interact with her parents, watching her parents, the very realistic portrayal, what I felt like of two parents going through this process, their child, all of that just drew me in and I just fell in love with it.
Mm. Yeah. And I think that's a big key for The Big Sick, which is it shows us love that is, that has nuance, and that I would say it isn't just what we see in most romantic comedies. I'm pretty sure it's the review at Think Christian. They talk about how most romantic comedies are basically mainly about romantic or erotic love. And it's not, like we already talked about, The Big Sick does start off as a story about romance or that kind of erotic love. But in the hospital waiting room, and when Camille demonstrates like a different kind of love, we get agape, like this self-giving love. And I honestly think that if you can display that or express that in a story effectively, that is incredibly more attractive than romantic or erotic love. I mean, not that there's anything wrong in and of itself conceptually with romantic or erotic love, but what makes us really fall in love with a character or fall in love with a story is when we get to see something like agape on display. When we see like a love that costs someone something, you know, not just like a speech in the rain, that's usually hollow, even though cinematically it looks great, but like watching him go back to the hospital, when he is not wanted, in the face of knowing that he has made a terrible decision, sacrificing possibly his family, possibly his career, like his expression of love for Emily is going to cost him something, and it might not be severely, but he doesn't know that. And as an audience, we don't know that. We don't know if he's going to lose his family forever. We don't know if he's going to miss out on like the one career opportunity he has. And I think that just shifts the entire focus of the film. But there's another piece to it that really made it stand apart for me too, which is something that I believe, Aaron, you were hitting on, where like you see the relationships with the family as well, mm-hmm. and how that is we are really like a really, really invested in Emily's parents, and the pain that they're going through and what love looks like from their perspective as well. I'm guessing that you guys were probably pretty big fans of Ray Romano in this.
Fantastic.
Oh, absolutely.
So what is it that we see from her parents that really kind of, that we can connect with, like, as people who are being told the story?
I think they feel like real people. I mean, they feel like a real married couple. Just the Holly Hunter's sort of barely restrained franticness and his trying to take it all in, what's going on. You know, I think you really get a sense that they are a married couple that have all this history and, you know, and they really feel like they're worried about their daughter. I mean, I think they just sell that right away from the beginning, mm-hmm. in those moments where they're talking to the doctors and stuff like that, you know. They just have a banter about them. You would have assumed that maybe this is a TV show or something where they've been playing a married couple for eight seasons or something, you know.
Yeah, and this is like that award-winning like sixth or seventh season before the rest of the series can't live up after that big moment.
Yeah, before, you know, one of the cast members leaves and he's replaced with a weirdly young son instead or something.
Well, if we're going to I'm going to make us harp on this thing because I think it's very interesting in contrast, especially considering, Aaron, your kind of desire to see there being consequences for like this hookup culture. And like I said, for some reason, I really feel like the need to apologize for us harping on this for so long. But I do think it's important that the thing that I really like, in contrast to us seeing almost no repercussions for the Kumail and Emily relationship starting from what seems to be kind of like a hookup, to the fact that Kumail, like, he, to a certain degree, could be considered like cheating on Emily if he actually thinks they're going to be together at all, with the parents, who I'm going to see their names right now, Terry and Beth. So we see what sexual sin can do, or what sexual infidelity can do to a relationship. And like, I think that's a great picture. And I think it's really odd that, there are these unsaid rules that like no one brings up the fact, or we never deal with in the film, that Kumail has like this other hookup outside of his relationship with Emily. But almost the whole relationship of Beth and Terry, we are dealing with Terry having this relation, or this one one stand where he actually says he feels guilty about it and wish he didn't do it right away. You know, where Kumail still, we see no remorse for what he has done, for immediately going out and hooking up with someone else. And as an audience, I don't feel like there's probably very many people who are like seeing these things as equal in any way. They're just like, oh yeah, well they were on a break, so it was fine. Or they thought they were broke up, so it's cool. But they were married, so this is a big deal. And I would say, yes, they are married, so it is a big deal. But I would probably posit that they're not as far apart as people may see them from this, like I said, this magic title that marriage gives them.
Yeah, I really like the contrast of their relationship as well, in particular because we don't know the depth of it. You know, we only get Ray Romano's kind of one time where he's explaining it to Kumail and explaining mm-hmm. what happened and giving him there's a really funny way where he says, well, you got to cheat on him to understand how much you love him. And Kumail's like, so he's like, are you telling me to cheat on your daughter? And it's really kind of hilarious because that's how real life is. Again, he's trying to express something that he doesn't quite grasp. and he's stumbling for words. And it's kind of awesome to see that because we can relate. One thing that I love about it is the end, when it's one of my favorite scenes. I actually wrote this down to mention, was when his mom, or her mom, sorry, Emily's mom, crawls into bed with her dad.
Yeah.
And it's just this simple, there's no words really. You know, she's like, can I come lay with you? I think she says, and she just comes over and she crawls in and they very lightly hug, you know, and go to bed. And I wanted to just break into tears at that point, because that was, you could feel like that they've gone through this very stressful, scary time together. They've realized they need each other and that they do love each other. And it felt like they'd gone through this trauma and it had led them to a place where they were ready to start reconciliation. And that was like the seed. That was the beginning of it. And I think that's how I felt from it. And so, yeah, it's that is awesome. And a really cool relationship for us to see portrayed on screen, you know, and it's just, it is weird that they just dropped the ball completely on the Camille cheating aspect and never mentioned it again. I guess maybe, you know, maybe the point of that is to, for us, that we're supposed to connect the dots and realize that Camille is going to make that, he's going to learn from this. So he's having this conversation with Emily's dad. He realizes what he's done in the past. And he's now learning, okay, that's not going to work.
Well, it's you. It's actually you mentioning that that's making me think. I'm wondering if I am just not giving the writers, I mean, basically, you know, Emily and Camille enough credit. Like, maybe they do understand that, because he basically, the way we're defining it, he does cheat on Emily. And it's after he cheats on Emily, like, immediately he's back in the Emily game. So maybe Ray Romano is basically just describing to us what has just happened and his terrible advice. Camille actually understands better than we think. See, if I just didn't stop and get on my high horse, then I could have.
I'd like to believe it that way, at least. I mean, if, you know, it's one of those things where
it's pretty,
it feels,
I mean,
better,
yeah,
to believe it, that that's what it means.
Yeah. Okay. So we, oh man, I feel like we really have, like I said, railed on this, like, the hookup culture a lot, which is not the intention, because there are some things that I actually do want to talk about. Again, not that that's not important. It doesn't need to be railed against to a certain degree. But I think something that this made me think of, because it's getting a lot of press, you know, Judd Apatow was even talking about how he was really attracted to the project because, you know, there was humor, there was relationships, but he really liked the themes of, like, religion and family and stability and stuff like that. And there's a lot of talk of cross-cultural things and being able to kind of, like, find love outside of, like, the places that you're told you can find love. You know, so, like, lots of this kind of love is bigger than you'd think. Love is, can transcend X, Y, or Z. X, Y, or Z being like your nation of origin, your general culture, your race, your religion, and stuff like that. But I think something that I would be interested, because I honestly don't know how you guys feel about this. I know, depending on what Christian website I go to, I will get probably slightly different answers to this. But I actually think it is a really big deal to date across religions. I think it makes it incredibly difficult, especially, this is where you hear people bringing up the Second Corinthians verse about not being unequally yoked. I think going into a relationship, if you're already a Christian, it's very, very tough to be with someone who's not a Christian. And before, like I said, I get off on some kind of other rant, because I feel like I've ranted a lot this episode. I'm kind of interested, like, Jeremy, like, have you given that a lot of thought? And what are those thoughts, if there are thoughts?
have I given it a lot of thought, like, in my own life, or?
Well, just in general, just like,
in, you know, general, like, the movement. Well, I mean, I was a youth pastor for several years, so we definitely harped on that. Well, first it was don't date, but then if you are going to date.
So what are the dangers that you're seeing? You know, like is this a big deal? Is if someone, you know, like is it a hard rule that you, if you're a Christian, you really shouldn't date someone who's not a Christian, or you shouldn't marry someone who's not a Christian? Or is it just, you know, is it a rule? Is it good advice? Is it like situational? Like where does it fall?
I guess if I were advising somebody, and I, again, don't know why anybody would come and ask me about this, but if they were, here's my dating history. I had like 4 dates with a girl that wasn't my wife when I was 21. And then I met my wife. So there's Jeremy's dating history. So,
extensive.
Yeah. Pretty. I was a playa. But anyway, I'd call it advice, but I'm not going to like put a rule on somebody else, but I would strongly advise against it. Just there's so much, just your priorities and everything about your life is so different if you're a Christian to a non-Christian. Not to say you can't have the same interest, or you don't want to, like, you know, that people who aren't Christians don't want to help people or do the things that a mm-hmm. Christian ought to do. But the reasons you do it, I just, it seems to me like that'd be like, I don't know, getting into marriage can be hard enough. It seems like that's like a super unnecessary minefield to put in there as well.
Yeah, it does seem like, especially when you talk about getting into marriage, like the Christian perspective on like what marriage is and the purpose of marriage is typically much different than the general idea of what marriage is. You know, we believe it's, I'm like trying to narrow down the purpose of marriage, for Christianity in like a sentence is so difficult, but you know, the general idea, what's that?
I said good luck.
Yeah. So like the general idea being, you know, it's basically one big metaphor for our relationship with Christ. Like we are just trying to relentlessly work towards the ongoing sanctification of one other person. And that is not the mission I hate using the word worldly marriage.
Well, do you want something secular
marriage, I guess. Marriage.
I can speak to this on a very personal level.
Aaron, would you speak to this on a very personal level?
So this, I've been married twice, and both times have been to non-believers or unequally yoked at the time. So in my first marriage, I married a Catholic who was not by any means practicing Catholic. And there was, it definitely was a very distinct difference. Trying to find a church was very difficult. I tried to bring her along. At first it was interesting to her, but ultimately it did not have the same familiarity and the same rhythms that she was needing and used to in order for her to feel like she was doing church right. And so that was always a conflict. And that marriage didn't last very long. But my second marriage, the woman I married, she did not know Christ at the time and did not for many years after. She had no background in religion at all. It was entirely a Camille and Emily type story, to be frankly honest. Like it was birthed out of the hookup culture, and I knew better, but I chose to ignore that because I wanted to follow my flesh and follow my earthly desires. And I thought, you know, oh, it'll be fine. And this is what people think. It'll be fine. I'll be able to, you know, convert them like you guys are talking about.
Mm-hmm.
But what I found quickly ends up happening is that the person that becomes converted is not the person that's the non-Christian. It's the Christian who begins to have their value system erode, whether it's intentional or not. It's them who ends up not wanting to have to fight the battle to go to church anymore, not wanting to go alone. And so they start skipping church. They start falling out of community. And then it becomes a whirlwind of a distance from God relationally. At least that's what I experienced. And I think a lot of that stemmed from not having that equal footing and foundation. When you, I mean, there's a reason that our marriages have those words in them, and that they're based on a common ground of understanding the Bible. If you don't have that standard that you can both agree to, then there's nothing to point you to get, like, there's nothing to bring you back together when problems occur, right? There's no central point to come to where you both say, okay, no matter what I feel, I'm going to at least believe that. But you don't have that, and when you're not equally yoked. And so it definitely contributed to the downfall of my marriage, I fully believe. And so since then, I have, you know, even just in dating, I won't go that route because it's not worth it. And I think you have to, it's troublesome sometimes. Because, you know, we find somebody that we like, you know, I might find somebody that's not a Christian, who's my Emily, who's witty and cute and adorable, and I have wonderful chemistry with, and might possibly have an incredible normal relationship with, but minus that piece, you know, as a Christian, that has to be the most important piece, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think, like, when I asked Jeremy, like, you know, is this like a rule, advice, or whatever, it also is very hard for me to say that it's a, like, it is a hard rule, only because God can use anything, you know, like he is bigger than the boxes that we try to put him in, or the situations that we try to create for ourselves to control situations, or say that this is right and this is wrong. Even though I'm not trying to be, like, you know, pluralist or relativist, like, there are right and wrong things, but trying to make a black and white out of a gray. And while I think this leans pretty heavily towards black and white, especially when we follow the Second Corinthians. And not only that, I think, Aaron, what you're talking about is what I see too. In almost every situation, and I say almost only because I feel like I'm probably forgetting one that might be the exception, but for the majority of relationships that I know where there is a believer and a non-believer in a relationship, I don't think I have once seen the non-believer like shift towards belief. It's always, or like I said, again, just anecdotal. So, like, you know, this isn't stats, but in my personal experience, I have seen, most of the time, the person who is the believer wanting to stay in the relationship so badly, which kudos to the desire. But in order to do that, they tend to move towards unbelief, for the sake of unity. And, I fortunately am not in a situation where I've had to ever make that choice. So I don't know, you know, what I would do. I hope I would not, you know, move towards unbelief, to sit, you know, to quote, save my marriage. But like I said, I think that's the easier thing. And as human beings, we tend to do whatever's easiest, whatever's most comfortable. And there's tends to be less friction going from belief to unbelief in those relationships. So while I do believe that, again, I think God can do anything, and he can use any set of circumstances to do his will, I think there's enough evidence, and I think there's enough wisdom that we can find in Scripture to say that it would be the rare, super rare, can't even think about it, still part of the cow kind of rare, like, exception for you to date outside of the Christian religion, if you are a Christian.
Right. Well, I mean, it's like most sin. Just because we know that God can be redeeming in that situation doesn't mean we should put ourselves in that situation to test him.
Yeah.
To say, okay, now you go do your thing, God. You know, I'm gonna go against what you're teaching and what you tell me to do, and put you in the position to now, you know, fix it or work a miracle,
make it good,
make it right. Yeah.
I'm bringing you these lemons. Come on.
Make lemonade, Lord. Oh. Get down.
I feel like that's a prayer that I would like legitimately hear like in like some kind of church, so it's like Southern
youth
church.
Conference.
Yeah, youth conference. That's a great place to have heard it.
Mm-hmm.
I think actually probably the best place that I would probably hear it is if we were watching some kind of like Christian parody, or not parody, but maybe satire.
If Christians made good parody.
Yeah, if we had the ability to do that. But it's like something I would expect to see like in the movie like Saved or something. You know, like what she prays there, like, Lord, I'm bringing you these lemons, you know.
It's got to be the last line of the prayer, like you're closing, like, Lord, we're bringing you the lemons. Make lemonade. And then, you know, amen.
Actually, I think that what I would, more than a person actually praying it, I just like that we're going through these script notes right here. Writing is rewriting. I think it would actually be the like hyperbolic, you know, tight jean hair youth pastor at the conference who's speaking.
V-neck, yeah.
Yeah, he would be the one giving like something about like lemons and like and ending it with like, Lord, we're bringing you our lemons. Like, say it with me. Our lemons are, you know, kind of like,
yeah.
That's kind of how I see it. Like something that would be completely
I've been to that youth conference.
Oh, haven't we all? Like, in some
yeah,
in some
I think
way.
We probably all.
Yeah,
have,
we've
yeah,
all been
actually.
To that youth conference.
I've been responsible for bringing youth to that youth conference, unfortunately.
Oh, the repenting you must have done.
I wanted to briefly though talk about just for a second his family, Camille's family, mm-hmm. and you bringing up the difference of religions triggered that, but. I find that part of the story fascinating
mm-hmm.
because we have his family and the way that they interact with him. I think that they're drawn in a way that we as a viewer are supposed to or are apt to look at them and go, oh, that's so terrible. Why are you being so controlling? You're just being domineering. You're trying to tell your son what to believe. You're trying to tell your son who to marry. And I think that there's more to it than that, both because for them culturally, their entire lives have revolved around a belief system that is their way of displaying love. And so to expect them to just change because Camille says, I disagree, isn't really realistic. And it's going to take time. It's going to be messy and painful, we're gonna see the conflict that we see, and so I enjoyed the way that that's portrayed, and I also think that we can look at that, at least I do, I look at that and I see that relationship and I wonder to myself, man, am I doing this anywhere in my own life? Like, is there anything that I'm pushing on my kids unknowingly where my kids may feel like I'm,
mm-hmm.
you know, my daughter pushes that on
board
me.
Games. Yeah.
That's a, why are we going through all my hobbies here? But seriously, like, you know, do we do this as well without it being as labeled? Maybe.
Well, no, not only would I say we do it, I would actually push back and say like, what's wrong with that? I remember watching, I mean, there are problems obviously with this and, so it's not as black and white as I'm going to probably present it, but I remember watching the movie Jesus Camp and
that sounds
like
terrible.
Yeah. And there are terrible things about it, but like there are terrible things that I watched in that movie, particular ways, and particular I think things that we would all see as like either poor theology or just poor ways of presenting the gospel that I would have problems with. But most of the criticism leveled against the actual movie were people saying, like, I can't believe, like, parents would teach their kids this stuff at, like, young ages before they had a chance to, like, think for themselves. And I'm like, yeah, that's not something I have a problem with. Like, if I believe something is true, and obviously I do, then why would I not teach it to my children? Now, I'm going to also teach them that people believe differently. And the reason, hopefully I can, you know, I'm not going to try to shelter them from that. But the idea that if I believe a way of life is the most beneficial, why would I not try to instill that upon my kids? Like, that just doesn't make sense to me. That's like, it seems like a terrible argument. And that argument that says, like, you shouldn't do anything is actually one of those things where it's like, that's your belief system that you're pushing on your kids. You believe that not telling them anything is the best route. So that's what you're pushing on them, a non-belief system, or a choose your own adventure system. Like, that's what you're hoping to do. So this is where I slyly and carefully shift the conversation over to Jeremy and say, Jeremy, you have all the children. How do you navigate these waters? Like, do you mind, like, or do you feel like compelled to examine all the things that you're teaching your kids, or do you feel pretty comfortable, like, instilling particular things in your children?
Yeah, you know, one thing that my kids have probably heard me say more than anything else is that when I
go
teach
Royals?
Them one of these, go Royals. I've created monsters. My kids are more pumped up about them than I am even right now. But they don't know that the playoffs aren't an option. Anyway, another thing they've heard me say, I guess, quite a bit is when I'll teach them something, I'm always make sure, you know, I always close our little talk by saying, but not everybody believes the way that we do, and we're not going to look down on other people for thinking the way that we do. We're not going to impose our beliefs on other people. We don't think that, whenever there's something like that, that I know that other people in my evangelical culture would strongly disagree with. There's things like that that I teach them and just say, you know, but we're not going to go bragging or, you know, just blabbing about this to everybody else. This is what our family believes. And just because some other family believes differently doesn't mean that they're right or they're wrong or whatnot. And, you know, they roll their eyes every time. But I believe that's important. Because I guess when it came to the family stuff, I could, you know, I don't want to, like, I mean, I'm a white guy. I'm not an immigrant. I don't want to, like, white explain this whole movie, but I could identify with Kumail and, like, the difficulty of, like, coming to your parents as a child and, like, disagreeing with the things that they hold dear. And, you know, I still don't always feel comfortable doing that when I disagree with something. Or when I change what I believe about something that's, you know, then opposes what my parents believe about something. And so I teach them that we, you know, it's okay to think differently, not just because of other people, but also because I want them to have that freedom when they grow up, if they think that, well, maybe dad wasn't totally right in this area, that they don't have a fear of coming to me and, you know, discussing it with me.
Yeah, but so is there a balance, though? Are you actually ever teaching them things where you're like, because the way you're describing it is almost everything that you are kind of instilling to them, you're giving them, you're kind of doing it very open-handed. But I imagine there's probably things that you're telling them where it's not just like, oh, well, that isn't, if they don't believe that, that doesn't make them right or wrong. Like, you would say, yes, like, we believe that, like, Jesus is Jesus. And if people don't believe that, well, they're wrong, but we don't hate them. Like there is like a, there are like, cause I'm stating it as a statement, but I'm wanting to ask it as a question. Like you are still doing this, right? Like there are things that you're not compromising on.
Like, yeah, like sex. So like, you know, just bring up the thing we've harped on in this movie. You know, my oldest is 11, so I haven't had like extensive sex talks or anything yet. They're coming so fast. Anyway, you know, when I have talked to him about that before, I've said, you know, without getting into specifics, this is something that we don't do. We believe that it's wrong. The Bible says that it's wrong. And our reading of the Bible says that it's wrong. And so I don't want you to behave in this manner, but you're going to have friends who don't think it's wrong. And we don't expect people who don't believe the way we do to behave the way that we do.
Mm-hmm.
So I do give them, I guess, what I would call some absolutes or, fairly unqualified rules. But it's always with that qualifier, just because I don't want to raise like self-righteous kids that think they're better than everybody else.
Yeah.
Because they're doing these things. And so that's the tough balance, I suppose.
So if we take these ideas and then move back into The Big Sick and we look at Camille's family and how, like, it's this depiction of a Muslim family that is very real and tangible, something I feel like we don't get very often in any movie, really, at least any movie that we have a chance to see in an actual theater near us. It's kind of interesting to see the things that they believe and how these things aren't like necessarily, like, they feel crazy to our culture, but again, I'm personally kind of like, well, I think some of the things that they're harping on actually seem closer to the values that I would hold to than the values that Kumail is kind of trying to get us on board with as audience members. Which leads me to my next question. Aaron.
Mikey.
Arranged marriages. Yes or no?
At this point in my life, as a single man for the last 7 years, yes.
Yes.
no. No, I am wholeheartedly against that. I feel like one of the podcasts that I've been on, somehow our conversation got to this exact same topic where we discussed dating apps, and I think it was with MJ. Now I'm trying to remember what it was, but I said the same thing, and that is that.
Oh, was that the Passengers episode about online dating? Yeah, it was.
Yes, exactly.
There because we go. Were. I remember about, that. That was awkward.
We were. That's not how you're supposed to remember it. But we were discussing how, you know, the
idea. How would you suggest I remember it?
Anyway. As awesome. Yeah. Like, I remember MJ really opening up and telling us about his life. And that was very revelatory and epic.
MJ was talking about how he met his wife online. And I was saying the current culture of doing that is very pick and choose. It's fill out an order form for the significant other that you want. And in a way, arranged marriage is that same thing, only the parents are the ones filling out the order form versus the actual person. And so I don't subscribe to this. I don't think that this is a good idea. However, I will say that I also, on the flip side, I fully believe love is an action. And you don't have to have a romantic spark in the very beginning of a relationship for it to turn into a true loving marriage. And so I think that arranged marriage can absolutely work. And the proof is there for, you know, decades and centuries of life, mm-hmm, all across the world. However, I would not personally want to be put in that position. I would want to have the choice.
So what you're saying is it's good for other people, just not you.
No, I'm saying I definitely just don't think that anyone should be forced to do it. However, mm-hmm. I think that those that may choose to willingly participate in that format of getting married.
Your voice is going so high right now. It's like...
I noticed it too. But I think it can, what I'm saying is I think it can work, but I think that it needs to still be a choice. Because then if I'm choosing to go that route for meeting a spouse, then I'm going to be more open and ready and willing and prepared to love unconditionally and by action than I would be if I was opposed to that style of marriage.
Nah, I'm just gonna be all against you on this one, Aaron. I just think that you arguing for that basically says I want the freedom to choose based on my own criteria, which in almost every case, this is like the rare case is like the virtuous case. You're choosing someone based on all the wrong reasons and then choosing love as an action to follow those to hopefully make it work as opposed, which I mean, I think is more comfortable for all of us. I mean, and it's probably the way that Jeremy and you and your wife got together. And I know it's the way that me and my wife got together.
We're arranged marriage.
That explains a lot. That explains so much.
Explains why she's still here.
Like I said, it would probably explain my marriage too. Cause, it was actually funny. I didn't actually say this to, my boss. It's really weird to think of her as my boss. The parish administrator, at my church is like, yeah, my boss, I guess. And so like we get lunch occasionally and, I always think that I want to say to her, like, you feel, or you're probably getting the exact same feeling that my wife feels all the time from these looks that people give. Like, why would she be with him? Just like trying to figure out what the stranger is thinking when they see us together. Mm-hmm. I'm like, this is, you know what my wife feels like now. All these people looking at you and then looking at me and then saying something like, can I take your order? But then they look back at you. And then they look back at me and they just kind of look at you like, are you okay? Do you want to be here? Like
this. That's is why I don't go with my wife to the mall. I don't like the looks.
Like, are you like his helper, or like, is he like in your charge for some reason, for medical reasons? Like, I don't.
Oh, know. Look, she's buying a meal for a homeless person.
Exactly. Like, especially when the beard gets grown out. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, so it's always interesting to see anyway that,
Can I come out pro, arranged marriage?
Well, so I want to be pro arranged marriage too, but now I want to know why you're pro arranged marriage.
Yeah. You guys are both safely married coming out pro arranged marriage. Well, see how this works. Throwing the single guy into the,
I've already admitted to the inherent bias or, the inherent irony, in our position. So with that said, Jeremy,
you know, so this is totally anecdotal. I'm not totally pro. I'm really not pro arranged marriage as far as whatever. But like my oldest sister, she is married to this wonderful guy who's actually the pastor of the church I go to. And like when she was in junior high, freshman in high school, like my parents were very good friends with the parents of the guy who she eventually married. And they said, like, they would literally get together because they wanted these two to spend time together. And so there was no, like, arrangement or anything like that. Like, we're going to give you our goats. No, goats or cows exchanged. Gotcha. No dowries. But, you know, I think that there is something to be said for, as parents, you know your children better than anybody else. So, I mean, I think when my son gets to be older, you know, there will probably be, you know, hopefully be women or girls that I would, you know, maybe point him to, or not
arrange him. There's no way that you can say that without it being creepy.
Creepy. Yeah, exactly. But I would, you know, I can't, he's 11. So he starts to get blushy and stuff when I start mentioning like other girls, but I think I try to open that window now, like that I'm talking about girls that he might know from church or whatnot, that so that in the, you know, in the future, hopefully he'll know that that door is open, and he'll know that maybe there's some blind spots that dad and mom see that he doesn't see, that maybe, you know, maybe he'd at least be willing to listen to our counsel when it comes to that sort of thing.
But you're also opening the, or if you want to stay single forever, like the Apostle Paul, we also are pro that.
Well, I see, I want my sons to get married so I can have grandkids, but my daughter, she can stay single and live with us for her whole life.
Well, good. Well, at least that is not sexist in any way, so that works pretty well for all of us.
She's just so wonderful and easy to get along with. It's not a sexist thing. Also, men are pigs.
Men are pigs. I would hope that we could all agree with that.
So if it's sexist, it's a pro-feminist sexist stance.
I feel like you just like started writing like a thesis or something.
Yeah, it sounds like it.
Yeah, I'm working on
something. Well, so when it comes to arranged marriage, I'm not like pro, like I think everyone needs to have an arranged marriage, but I think the concept behind the fundamental concept behind arranged marriage is the thing that's most profoundly almost in line with what ultimately actually, Aaron, you're arguing for, which is that like love is an action. Love is a decision that we make. It's like a vow that we make for something that we're going to be doing way in the future. And so it doesn't matter like what somebody's like now. Like we are committing to this relationship for a long time. And that is only, you know, that is only going to work if there is action upon action upon action, always moving in that direction. Now, I would, you know, my caveat would be that I think it helps if there is some level of attraction, but I have found that in my own life and in the stories of a number of other people, I feel like I'm using these very random, nondescript kind of stats on this episode a lot, but you know, I've heard over and over and over, like the more you love someone as an action, the more that you see this like agape, this like self-sacrificing love for someone, the more like attractive that person becomes to you. I said there was someone from a couple years before I met my wife, who I was not attracted to, even though everyone thought she was attractive. Like, I just didn't think she wasn't my type, if I had a type. But we were really good friends, and we hung out for a lot of time, and people would joke about us, and I'd be like, really, she's not my type at all. But we hung out, and we hung out, and we hung out, and eventually she became my type. Now, fortunately, it didn't work out, because that would have been a train wreck for various reasons. But like, I could see that, when you grow to love someone, through your actions, through your pursuit, like it can fix that whole like attractiveness thing, which is usually what, you know, most relationships start on, much like this one, you know, in The Big Sick. Two people found each other attractive, got started. Like, there wasn't like there was like some kind of semblance of like, oh, you're kind of funny, you're kind of witty, but it was mostly just like, I'm attracted to you, you're attracted to me, let's do this. So arranged marriages kind of take that out of it. Again, it does help to have some kind of level of attraction. It does help to have some kind of level of similar hobbies, things that you like to spend time doing. And of course, the arranged marriages probably would never have this problem. But if, again, like we've talked about, if there wasn't like a similar religion, then that would obviously make things incredibly difficult, because religion typically helps you define how religion or irreligion helps you define what you think the purpose of marriage is for in the first place. So, even a non-Christian religious arranged marriage, even though it's not the Christian one, they're still getting married for the same, like they both the people in the marriage are in the marriage for the same reason. It's probably for procreation and things like that. but they're on the same page. So I tend to be idealistically in favor of arranged marriage, believing that most people with enough work and effort could make it work out. But it brings up that question we asked on the La La Land episode, which is like, do you believe in soulmates? You know? And if there's a way, mainly because I'm mentioning La La Land again, I'm kind of curious, like, Aaron, is there a soulmate?
So this is a very personal, I mean, it's hard to not answer this from a, with a, you know,
yeah.
There's a personal spin to it. I do not believe that there is one person for us. Mm-hmm. So no, there's not. I don't believe that. Sometimes I want to, and sometimes I try to convince myself that when it is appealing. But no, I don't think you can believe that love is an action and that love is something that, like you said, is a you grow into it. You do it. You become loving by sacrificing and such. I don't think you can believe that and think that that could only apply to one person.
Gotcha.
Because then there's a condition. So
yeah, so what you're saying is that you don't believe in the sovereignty of God. Got it. So, Jeremy, why did you take that, Aaron? Why did you take that?
This guy.
That I'm just saying.
Because I'm beaten down. I can't even defend myself anymore. No.
No. I think that's like I have given it only a cursory amount of thought and I haven't come to any conclusion, so I'm not going to fight you either way. I'm genuinely just curious, kind of how you feel about it. And I'm curious about Jeremy, like what you think about it as well.
Oh, I definitely don't feel like there's, I don't feel like there's just one person for you. I mean, like, I feel like currently there's just one person for me for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
But you know, if I could go back and tell, you know, 23-year-old Jeremy, who was, you know, worried that he was going to miss the boat so often with a girl, that, hey, he'd probably be just as happy if with somebody else, if you learned how to love them correctly. I think I would have, you know, not had so much heartache at such a young age.
Yeah, I mean, I do feel that in general we're told that there is a, like, you know, the romantic comedies and stuff work, or romantic films in general, what do we call them? Dramances. They tend to make a lot more money if they're pitching us the idea of that, like, there is one person. But that, like I said, neither here nor there about how, you know, if love is an action, then they really missed the boat in La La Land because they just chose not to have any actions at all. But, you know, none of us have opinions about that. Moving on. One of the things that I really didn't realize, because I'm going to circle back around to the first question that I didn't answer about, like, something that I didn't realize about this film, kind of going into it, is I didn't realize until I was watching this film that Michael Showalter actually directed it. And I actually like the stuff that Michael Showalter does. He is part of that crew that was part of The State on MTV back in the day, for anyone actually old enough to remember that. You know, he's been involved in lots of things like Wet Hot American Summer and stuff like that, for those of you who share that type of comedy. And
yeah, that's good.
And he commented on the second act's darker, though still humorous tone, after Emily goes into her coma, that he said that the movie approaches life with the idea that no matter how bad a situation gets, you've got to have humor. And that's one of those things that I read, like, in trivia, and I think it's obviously in the movie, it's thematic in the movie that, like, you know, there's a time for weeping, there's a time for laughter and stuff like that. But I think it's one of those things where I see someone say something that they think is an obvious thing or an encouraging thing to say, but what they're actually saying is something that you can find in the wisdom of Scripture. Because, I mean, what he's basically saying is, a joyful heart is good medicine. Thanks, Proverbs. And I mean, it's something that I've found, again, anecdotally true in my own life, like going through some of the toughest things that I've ever gone through, being able to have friends come along and just sit with me, or just sit with me in the pain, but still have a chance to and make room for laughter and fun. You know, appropriately timed laughter and fun, which is actually something I struggle with because I tend to try to make everyone laugh all the time, especially in tragedy. So I tend to sometimes not hit the laughter at the proper times. But the ability to remind ourselves that, like, life is still worth living and there is still good. And in our particular case as Christians, there is something bigger than our circumstance, our tragedy. And being able to enjoy life or being able to have some type of joy is a medicine. And it's one of the things that I really enjoy about this, because even though it is dark in the second act, even though one of the two main love interests is in a coma, and they actually play it up pretty well that, like, even though I realize in real life that what the story, how the story is going to end, I'm like, is it going to end that way?
Yeah, she could die.
Yeah, like the way the story was told, I was actually not sure, even though I was sure how the film actually ended. So it was nice to have these scenes of levity. I mean, it was nice between you know, Emily's parents, just these situations that were these tense situations that were deflated by comedy. And honestly, one of the reasons that I've enjoyed, and I've told this to you before, Jeremy, one of the things that I really appreciate about you being a part of the real world community is your levity. So I'm kind of curious, how do you deal with tough situations? Do you go to laughter as well? Because, like, I feel like I would assume that is the case.
Yeah. I think that was one of the things that, like, made the movie feel so real to me, is mm-hmm. because when I am in those situations, that, you know, that's how, at least when I'm in those situations, I'm obviously around, and that's how I get through it, is by making a joke, or, you know, even if it's just telling a funny story about the person who we're concerned about or whatever, is I guess, like you, maybe I tend to go maybe even overboard because I'm uncomfortable with those sort of situations. But yeah, that's I don't know how you would make it through something like that if you didn't take the time to be that sort of thing. I always joke, like, when people are, like, when people invite me to move, like, help them move or something like that, like, or paint, I'm worthless at that sort of thing, but I'm really good at sitting around and, like, keeping morale high and telling people jokes, you know? So I'll come and I'll drink your soda and I'll tell you jokes, or the same thing. Like, when we have kids, we have a friend who's like a doula. And so she does all the stuff that the husband normally does. And I just kind of sit there and tell jokes. And, I don't know. There are times where maybe my wife might give me a look and I know, okay, we're crossing a line here. But, I just don't understand. I don't know how, I definitely err on the side of maybe being too quippy or too funny, but I don't know how anybody would get through those times without that sort of levity.
Yeah. I mean, I know it tends to be a blanket statement. But sometimes when, like, my wife and I get in intense discussions, like, I will often, like, when things get a little too serious, I will start cracking jokes and it just pisses her right off.
Yeah, it makes it way worse.
Yeah, it makes it way worse. And, but I just, she's like, why would you joke right now? And I'm just like, I can't, like, there are so few things in life with the perspective that I have on life that are that serious to be that mad at for that long. Like, I understand that this is serious, but it doesn't mean, like, I just can't stay mad that long. Like, it's just not in me. I'm like, in the scope of eternity, whatever we're arguing about, because this is what I usually tell her. And I don't know if this helps or not, and she's probably gonna listen to this, and I've told her this before, so she can always like let me know at some point. But I was like, when we're fighting and I'm upset for some reason, after a couple minutes, like something in me kicks in, and like I'm just looking at her and she's talking or telling me, or she's airing her grievances to me. And it almost is one of those like out of body experiences where I see myself listening to her, but I have no idea what she's saying.
Oh geez. Yeah.
But like, it doesn't, like, because it doesn't, it matters, but to me it doesn't really matter, because in this out of body experience, all I can think of is like how non eternal whatever we're fighting about is, and how much I am incredibly in love with this person. So whatever I am trying to hold my ground for is just not that big of a deal. And
you're like Bo Burnham in The Big Sick. We're on a planet and a bunch of planets in a galaxy of millions of galaxies. So what if I forgot your birthday?
Yeah, I'm just like, I know, like what's the big deal? And that's how I feel. And so then, you know, then inevitably, once I have this like out of body thought and realize how, like, ultimately, again, cosmically and eternally, whatever we're fighting about actually is, like, I start smiling, like in real life and not in my out of body experience. And then she gets real mad because she thinks I think it's a joke. And you know, it's like
you've got a camera in my living room.
then she typically gets more upset because then she thinks it's a joke. But we've been married long enough now that she realizes like I obviously care about her feelings mightily. And we've had this like post-argument about it enough. But like I said, like cracking a joke or laughing together just kind of melts away whatever tension is between us. And it really is the medicine that like keeps us together a lot of times. When we're at odds or at a disagreement. And again, bad timing aside, I really feel like that, like I said, that concept of a joyful heart, which honestly I feel like very blessed, I think, to have, in the perspective of eternity, allows me to keep things pretty copacetic on my end. You still have to be there in the moment and empathize, and like you have to work these things out. You can't just like crack a joke and then pretend the whole problem, whatever the problem was, didn't exist or doesn't need a solution. But it certainly starts the healing, if done right, again, which I admittingly don't do very well a ton of the time. Right. But anyway, I feel like Jeremy, you and I have talked, and I say you and I, covering for the fact that I've just talked a lot and given personal anecdotes. But Aaron, I was kind of curious what your thoughts on this whole concept of kind of being a romantic comedy. Obviously laughter is a part of it, but it's not just cheap laughs. It's not like the laughs that you mentioned earlier where people go to like, you know, fart and dick jokes and stuff like that. Like it's actually kind of like thoughtful comedy that actually has purpose, not just to make the audience laugh, which it does, but the impact that has on you as a viewer when the comedy is actually used to move our characters forward in the story and through pain.
Yeah, I mean, I would echo everything you've just said. I mean, not necessarily in a marriage relationship example, but in any example, I think that laughter and comedy can be used to connect us. Those of us, like, if we're not connected, so in a situation where what we see from Camille, one of the best lines in the movie is the most awkward to me, and that is when they're sitting in the cafeteria and he's there with the mom and dad, and she says, "I've always wanted to ask you, you know, ask someone, what do you think about 9/11? And he says, oh, it was a tragedy. You know, we lost 19 of our best people. And just, I feel like, I mean, he immediately, you know, admits that he's joking. He corrects him. You know, he explains that. But that kind of thing, I think, can create a bond. It can start a bonding process for people. And right after that is when, I believe right after that scene is when they call the parents to the room, to Emily's room, and the mom says, no, I don't want him to come. And dad says, yeah, he can come. Right. Yeah. So it begins a process for them, just the little bits of humor there. I think there's a fine line, because there are people that use, and Camille is one of these people. Being a comedian, he also tends to use his comedy as a defense mechanism.
Yeah.
You know, when something he doesn't want to actually have to deal with, telling the truth or dealing with something head on, he tries to deflect and make it funny. And so there's a real balance in when to use it and when not to use it, I think.
Well, and that is you uncovering what I'm considering a strength. Or I'm guessing same thing with Jeremy. What we're considering strengths, the being able to laugh in times of tragedy as just our sad, sad coping mechanism.
Yeah, absolutely.
Deflecting from having feelings.
Yeah, I lost my mom 3 years ago, and having people be funny, obviously not in the moment, but kind of pretty soon directly after that, I didn't want to wallow in my misery. Like, I needed to laugh. I needed to have some release. We see that. We see what there's a great scene at home, right, where they go on binge eating and drinking, and they're just finally letting go of some of that pressure. You've got to release it, and comedy is a great thing for that. And so this movie puts us in the position to really feel that strongly. I mean, I felt it like I was connected to the characters.
Yeah.
And I needed that release too, and it worked out perfectly.
Well, it definitely, I think it's one of the easiest ways, or most effective ways. Maybe that's the way I want to say it, to kind of start bringing those walls down that people put up. Especially when they're hurting. I think comedy can kind of be like an equalizer. Again, timely and not inappropriate timed comedy. But and it's like the first couple steps across a bridge that we build towards other people. It's just like that. I just think of that like kind of like laugh, like when you kind of say, you kind of like, haha, are we okay? You know, like you give that look and you open someone else to, or you open yourself up for someone else to kind of step in and give them the opportunity. I think it's beautiful. I love to see, people laughing. It's one of those reasons why comedies are almost always more funny when you're watching with your friends, than when you're just, yeah, like I said, when it's just you, like something you're like, ha ha, you look around, like, I believe like laughter and joy are meant to be shared. And I think even if you don't think you're hurting, I think, a joyful heart is great medicine. It's almost like it becomes less medicine and more of like a daily vitamin or a daily supplement. So, you know, laugh
I
on.
Just, I think there's a level of intimacy that comes from being able to laugh in that sort of a situation. You know, I mean, I'm just thinking back to like my grandpa passing away a few years ago. You know, I don't remember a thing that the priest at his church might have said at the funeral. But what I do remember is sitting in a circle afterwards with his friend, with my cousins and my, you know, my aunts and uncles and my dad, and telling stories about, you know, how bad he used to be at giving directions, or because there's like this intimacy. It's like that that's created there that lasts a lot longer than, you know, I mean, anybody can come and just sit with you and be sad, but to be able to make you laugh in that sort of time, I think it's a gift that comes with intimacy.
Yeah, I since we're all are all telling personal sad tragedy stories, I remember losing a friend in college, and it was, I mean, it was incredibly sad to see someone who was like the same age as you. I mean, like, he was technically younger, but more or less the same age as you, like, die. And going up to his hometown for his funeral that weekend, I have very few memories of, like, for better or worse, like, sitting with people and, like, crying and being sad. Most of the things that I actually remember are, like, having tons of people crammed into my little, like, Saturn sport coupe that should have only had, like, 3 people and it had, like, 6. Like all of us laughing and listening to music and miming things to Ben Folds songs. And then probably the cherry on top is one of those moments that I feel like it should have been in a movie where my friend that passed away, he and I and another friend had like a little, it wasn't like a band. It was a band. We had a band, and we were really enjoying playing together, and we had just recorded like on our friend's computer, like our first demo, like 4 or 5 songs. And, I mean, just a couple weeks before, and I got it and I took that and I gave it to his mom, 'cause his mom had never heard a lot of his songs, since he was away at college and he hadn't played them for her. And she was like, I'm going to get tons of copies of this made and let his voice like be one of the last gifts that we give to people at the funeral. And I was like, that's awesome. And she was like, what was your band called again? I said, oh, we're called Inward Drive, which is totally like a early 2000s name that a Christian college band would have. And I was so excited. We got, it was after the funeral, we were all sitting around like meeting family and talking and sharing great memories. And she brings out this huge stack of CDs and is like, here's my son's band. I'm really glad they got to do this. And we're passing out, and we see every one of them on the thing has an imprinted sticker that said like, Inside Deeper. And I looked at it and I looked in disbelief at like this incredibly awfully innuendoed name that was misspelled. And I just started kind of chuckling like almost uncontrollably, because one, it was such an incredible mishearing of what our actual name was. And then there was this piece of me that was like 13 again, and just the entire phrase Inside Deeper was so hilarious to me. Like, this is my pinnacle memory of being at the funeral for one of my good friends. Like, I don't remember, like I said, I don't remember lots of the pain, I don't remember lots of the sadness, but I remember these times where we were laughing about something so ridiculous. And, you know, I don't really think back to those that weekend with a lot of pain. I think about how I had friends and people in my life that still made like life okay despite tragedy. It took time, right? It always takes time. But now we've all shared a personal story. And Aaron died.
That's nice.
No, Aaron didn't die. I'm here. I'm listening. Just taking it in.
Just soaking it in.
I mean, it's personal stuff. I'm not Camille, so I don't have a witty quick little joke to bring the levity.
Mm. Well,
and I don't have that balance, so I'm just keeping my mouth shut.
I have learned my lesson, so I got nothing. Well, I still haven't learned my lesson, so I'm always going to say something inappropriate. That's That's my deal. It's what I do. And just because I realize there's something wrong doesn't mean I need to fix it, because, you know, God likes forgiving sin. I like sinning. So what a great match, right? Good theology to end this episode. So something that I want to make sure we do, I would normally have time for kind of come on moments, because we've been going on for quite a while actually. But I feel like we should just like chalk up one big collective moment to our dissatisfaction with hookup culture.
We are definitely collectively against
that. Yeah, we are collectively against that. And
taking a stand, real world theology is against hooking.
Against hookup culture. the befuddlement with Kumail like hooking up and then being in love with Emily, and that whole befuddling idea behind this movie. So if we just put that as our come on moment, let's move straight to favorite moments. One, so we can expedite the ending of this episode, and two, because I really want to hear anything that we haven't mentioned, because it's the Big Sick. I'd kind of be interested when you tell me your favorite moments. Tell me what star rating. We don't usually do this, but I'm pretty sure we all really, really love this movie. And I'm kind of curious where you guys landed. Well, I know what Aaron's is. Aaron gives everything 5 stars. So besides Aaron, mainly just Jeremy, what did you, what was your favorite moment of this film, Jeremy?
Okay, I only have 7. So,
okay.
I'm making a list. Kidding. I'm going to give you 2. I always like to, when I'm watching movies, I always like to like come up with what I think is my funniest scene of the year of any movie. Mm-hmm. And I think there are 2 in this movie that are in the top 5 so far. One being that all-time great September 11th joke that I knew was coming because I had heard an interview with Ray Romano beforehand. But it did not. I mean, every time I've seen the movie, it just cracks me up. It's so awkward, and I love it. And then the other is the first time he meets a girl at the kitchen table, and she says something about the X-Files, and then she just kind of nervously blurts out, "The truth is out there." I love it. Anyway, so those are my favorite funny moments. And then I really like the last scene of Kumail in the hospital when he's talking to Emily's mom, is that Beth? Mm-hmm. And she comes out in the hallway, and he says something about, like, who would have thought, you know, that you'd be so excited for your daughter to go through physical therapy, and, you know, I feel so weird that we've gotten to know each other so well, but now I'll probably never see you again. And she just puts her hand on his face and says, maybe, but I hope not. And I love that moment between the two of them. And I just, you know, I'm starting to tear up a little bit now just talking about it. But I think it's just this beautiful culmination of how these two, or these three different people who'd never known each other, were able to form a strong bond through tragedy. And I just love that moment. That's my favorite moment.
Cool. Yeah, obviously all good moments. Aaron, I do want to hear what you have to say.
What was Jeremy's star rating?
Oh yeah.
Oh, I've given it 5 out of 5 all 3 times that I watched it.
Nice.
Okay. Awesome. I think it's interesting, Jeremy, because listening to yours, and then I'm going to give mine, and none of them involve Kumail Emily moments, which is what this movie is about. So it's very intriguing. Obviously the 9/11 joke, as I mentioned, was a high point for me. I think there's 2 other quick things that really I resonated with the most. And one of those was Kumail's breakdown at the fast food restaurant. And I think it's because I've felt that before. And so for a guy that we talked about, uses humor as his deflector and his ability to handle the pressure and the stress of life, he finally cracks. And I think most of us have been there, and whatever the reason may have been around it, but we've all reached that breaking point where we kind of step outside of ourselves and do something that we're we're not proud of and that we would not normally do. And of course he quickly corrects himself and he's like picking up the trash can that he just knocked over. And I just think it's both hilarious and tragic and so sad because of the way that he is, raging over cheese. And it's like, it's just something that I can totally understand happening. Mm-hmm. So that moment for me was a big one. And then the last scene with his parents where he's talking to them and he's about to leave the house and he says, "You can't kick someone out of your family because they will always be your family." And that one always just kind of gets me teary. Because there's no resolution. You know, I think it's after that that his dad pulls up and brings him the food from his mom. but we don't have a nice ending to that story.
Yeah.
You know, it's left there. But that line was just super powerful to me, and I think is important because it's true. You can not talk to someone and you can choose to not have them be a part of dinners and events, but that you cannot change the fact that someone is your actual family. And it was a really profound thing for Camille to say. So those were my moments. It's a 4.5 star for me. The half star comes off because of the sexualized background of them getting together. And then also I think it's just a little bit too long and could have been a little tighter. I think most comedy dramas like this, romances, should be, 90 minutes to, an hour and 45 minutes or so, and not slightly over 2 hours. But that's where I was at.
In the tradition of having favorite moments that aren't actually necessarily scenes, but either ideas, characters, or something like that, I think in an odd way, I want to say that, like, maybe Bo Burnham was my favorite part of this movie. Not necessarily his particular character, but just like this. Like what his character ended up bringing to the film, because one, it reminded me that I just think Bo Burnham is really, really funny almost all the time.
That's great.
And
can we point out the, I love the, he's like Daniel Day-Lewis, but he sucks.
Yeah. Sucks. Yes. So yeah, he's just like giving lines like that. And, it was always, for me watching this movie, like anytime things got a little too serious or too pouty or whatever, like he was there to be like the kind of like cynical jerk friend that reminds you that like things might not be that serious. In that kind of almost full, like FOOL, the full kind of like unintentional way, someone who's brilliant, but he's accidentally being brilliant, or being helpful, but not in the way that he thinks he is. So that are, surprisingly, Ray Romano. I think, we all mentioned that he was great. I've only seen a handful of episodes of Everyone Loves Raymond, and they annoyed me for reasons most sitcoms annoy me. But if this is some kind of like Romanaissance, I'm okay with that.
Romanaissance, that's fantastic.
So if I get more movies that he happens to be in like this, where he kind of just is ad-libbing and bringing like this very human element to a character, then I'm fine with that. I'm 100% fine with that. And I hope to see more of it, but, like I said, I this movie reminded me that I like romantic comedies. I just like five romantic comedies a lot. Like I said, I like them when they're done right, and they so rarely are. So, kudos to all the people. I just want to make sure that that they both got shout outs for the things they did. But like all the supporting cast was helpful. All of his friends and their weirdness, Mary and his roommate Chris, like they were, you know, they nailed it too. So, it, yeah, great casting. That was my favorite thing. Just great casting. A lot of fun. So, with that said, I think
star rating.
My star rating, I think I gave it 4 stars. I would have probably given it 4.25 stars if there was such a thing, because it's leaning towards 4.5 stars. But I feel like I have to defend my 4-star movies now, which is so silly. I've started as of like 2 years ago. I transitioned my system to a pretty rigorous system. Like it's like, I have to be insanely, fond of a movie for it to get like 4.5 stars. And I think it has to be something that will hold up as like an all time great for 5 stars. Yeah, or like, you know, fair. some kind of like high cult classic. Like it's going to, you know, we're going to be talking about it years from now.
Mother.
Yeah. And so, and that's the thing. I don't think Mother is going to be there, but that's a conversation for next episode. Maybe we'll see when I can get that scheduled.
So do you, when it comes to rom-coms, do you think that, The Big Sick is one we'll still be talking about in, 15 years?
I hope so, but for some reason I don't think so. I think the problem with The Big Sick is that it will never get the exposure that it should have to be like that. Like I think when you're talking about rom-coms that are gonna stay in that, like you're gonna get like the When Harry Met Sally kind of thing. Yep. You're gonna, mm-hmm. I mean, even Love Actually. I mean,
just watched that. Yeah, which yesterday.
Yeah, actually, you know what's funny? Never mind. I'll tell you later. I'm going to write a note down. Tell Aaron funny story after podcast. Aaron, funny story. I got to spell right too.
Can I stay on and listen to the funny story?
Maybe. Actually, everyone will probably hear the funny story at some point, but, cause we never stop recording. yeah, I mean, so like Love Actually, I mean, it does benefit from kind of like falling in that it's a Christmas movie kind of too. So, like I don't actually think Love Actually is a 5-star film, but it's a really good romantic comedy, dramance, whatever I'm trying to coin. I'm just trying to make all kinds of words up tonight. But something like that, something that like gives you a reason to revisit it over and over and over. And I don't think there's a lot of romantic comedies that are like that. I want The Big Sick to be. I just don't think it will be. I don't think it has like the star power or the production or the not the production but the marketing behind it to reach a big enough audience for that to happen. So
yeah, you're probably right.
Yeah, but if this movie would have gotten like a huge release and lots and tons of marketing beforehand, and it would have just added like one A-list kind of star as like a supporting actor, then it probably would have been seen by enough people that it could have been talked about. I think quality wise it should be up there, but anyway, sadly, I don't think it will actually be up there. But that aside, I assume that if you're listening to this episode that you have probably seen this movie. I hope you've seen this movie. If not, I hope, despite our rambling at the beginning about our one big issue with the film, that you see that there is a lot going on in this film, a lot more than your typical rom-com, enough that we have been talking about it for quite some time, and it has sparked all kinds of very interesting questions that the movie itself didn't necessarily ask, you know, specifically. And we have not even talked about everything. I've still got notes that I'm like, we just can't get to that right now. So, I hope, you go see this movie. I think we could all highly recommend it. And I think it would be well worth your time to check out and then have a conversation, with especially, I think, if you are married or have a significant other, it would be a really interesting conversation, or just, you know, a group of friends like we always suggest. In the meantime, it is time to wrap up. And when we wrap up, we point out that great conversations happen because we have great guests that give of their time to be on the show, not only to be on the show, but to watch the film, to prep for the show, and to talk about it. So I want you to be able to connect with them. So Jeremy, where can people find you on the interwebs or follow anything that you do there?
You can find me lurking in the Real World Theology group on Facebook. I also am active in the Feelin' Film group on Facebook. I do a weekly column about TV shows on feelinfilm.com, and I'm not a great writer, but I watch a ton of TV. So what I don't have in prose, I make up for in like weird trivial knowledge. So and Aaron's wonderful enough to let me, you know, get better on his site. So we've taken a few weeks off because there's literally like nothing on TV right now, and we'll get back in the swing of things next week. So, and then on Twitter, I'm at Jay and Lincoln. But if you follow me there, you're going to be disappointed at how many Kansas City Royals and Nebraska Cornhuskers tweets you get.
Awesome. Well, I'll make sure those in the show notes too, for all the Royals fans out there, or the budding Royals fans. Because let's be honest, no one's really a Cornhusker fan anymore. You know, like, why would you be?
Just the sad, lonely souls that were alive and living in Lincoln in the 90s.
That's right. All right, Aaron, same thing, man. How can people follow the stuff that you do, the one or two things that you do?
One or two. I wish it was only one or two sometimes. I am the co-creator and co-host of the Feel and Film podcast. And yeah, Jeremy writes for our site. I've also recently started some written reviews as well that are being posted on feelandfilm.com. I'm a member of the Seattle Film Critics Society, and I also have a secondary podcast with Real World Rewind host Blaine Grimes. We do a podcast together called Tabletop Flicks, where we pair board games and movies together that have a common theme, and just talk about what fun it would be to play those together in the same night, or play the game and watch the movie in the same night. And then I guess you can find me on Twitter and on Facebook, both at Aaron L. White, AaronElWhite, and I'm also frequently active in the Real World Theology group and love to talk to everybody there. If you have anybody you want to arrange a marriage with me, you know, let me know.
I do, but like it's on the wrong side of the country. That's the thing.
But it's an arrangement. It's meant to be, right?
Well,
we can make it work, because
we can make it work, but like you would actually have to meet to make it work. So
it would, she would have to make it work. So she would have to move.
If you guys wanted to meet in Nebraska halfway,
there we go. That's brilliant.
I would give you two separate rooms, so there's no hookup culture going on in my house. And you guys, I'd even chaperone.
Deal.
That's love right there.
That is awesome.
That's agape. self-sacrificing.
It's only self-sacrificing if he brings his cats.
That's true. Wait, do you have more than one cat? I thought you only had one cat.
I have three.
Oh, wow.
Two broke guys and three cats.
Gosh. Things all of a sudden became very clear. That's very mean of me to say. I apologize. If you want to tell me how insensitive I am to people who own three cats, you can do so at Fizzification on Twitter. If you'd really like to stalk me and give me lots of messages about how insensitive I am and use humor at the wrong time, then you should join the aforementioned Real World Theology discussion group on Facebook, or follow us on Facebook on the actual Real World Theology page. Two separate pages, both of them equally important. That's not true. The Facebook discussion group is way better. You should join that one. Anyway, you can also find the show notes to this podcast and all the ways that you can connect with our guest at realworldtheology.com. Also, go to realworldtheology.com/support. You can find great ways to actually make sure this podcast continues. Or if you just really love it, find ways that you can help us make the show better from here on out. So as always, don't forget to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, whatever whatever strikes your fancy, whatever podcast app you prefer to use on whatever platform makes you the happiest. Because we are fine with you dating around with podcast apps, trying to find the one that you like the most. In the meantime, for Real World Theology, I'm Fizz, reminding you that story is powerful and entertainment is not mindless. Bye-bye.
This podcast has been a Real World Theology production. For more information, check out realworldtheology.com. And thanks for listening.
Now this is podcasting. Woo!
She said, I don't understand how Aaron watches so many movies. Like does he watch like 6 movies a day? Like, what does he really not have a job?